Finger by the Barquets, and this is Rachel Wharton. I'm a deputy editor of Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan. This is Brooklyn Eats on heritageradionetwork.com, and our sponsor tonight is Whole Foods. I am here with four of the most awesome food writing women in the country, and tonight we're going to talk about food writing, what we like, what we don't like, what we expect to see, what we want to see more of. First, I have to introduce all four of them, which is hard because they are so talented and do so many wonderful things. First, we have Annalise Griffin. Annalise, say hello.
Hi, Rachel.
How are you? Annalise is the editor-in-chief of Brooklyn-based, which is you can pitch in whenever I'm...
It's an email newsletter. Based.
And she also is the editor of The Local, or works The Local, which is...
I'm the collaborative editor of The Local.
Collaborative editor
there's a lot local. Of... I wear a lot of hats, and there's also a lot of roles at The Local.
Which The Local is a blog... some of the Times local neighborhood blogs, and Annalise, I think you do Fort Greene and Clinton Hill.
Yes, that's right.
And she also works with my other guest, Indrani Sen, who is also a professor at CUNY's Graduate School of Journalism.
Hi.
Hello. And what else do you do?
I'm also a freelance writer, and I'm working temporarily on The Local as an editor.
Excellent. Ava Chin, who is the urban forager and wrote an excellent post recently on The Local about tapping maple trees for syrup in Brooklyn.
Hello.
Anything else?
Yeah, I'm also an assistant professor of journalism at CUNY as well, the College of Staten Island.
There you go. And Tracy McMillan, who's going to explain what she does. I know she's working on a book right now about crappy jobs in three levels of the food industry: supermarkets, restaurants, and farms.
Farms, yes. Okay. So basically, it's like the omnivore's dilemma meets nickel and dimed, and then I do some freelance work on the side as well.
Excellent. Okay, so now that I've used up my first 12 minutes on just telling everyone what you guys do for a living, I want to talk about food writing. My boss, Brian Howell, the publisher of Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan, recently, there's been a couple of panels recently about the future of food writing, and he recently wrote a thing on ediblemanhattan.com about how no matter what's going to happen, he's super excited because he feels like now more than ever, food is really being used as a lens into culture, philosophy, politics, so on and so forth, rather than just recipes. And that's basically, I think, what all five of us in this room like to do when it comes to food writing. You guys agree?
And yeah. So, yes, definitely.
I wanted to start by just asking one or two of you, maybe Tracy, because I think what you're doing is really interesting right now. What was the last thing you read or something recently you read where you were like, holy shit, that's an amazing article, and that's really what I want to be doing. That's my goal.
In terms of what I want to be doing, I feel like I come at food writing from a kind of a different perspective because I'm actually trained as a poverty and welfare reporter. So for me, the social implications and political implications around food are really fascinating. So like, I really paid a lot of attention to this piece that Corby Cummer did on the Atlantic's Food Channel around Walmart. But part of me was sort of like, it's not actually that shocking that Walmart has produce. Right. Because it was sort of like, oh,
wow. Is
that
the gist of his article?
Well, it's sort of like, wow, like, look, like Walmart can actually be a real resource for communities that don't have food. And, you know, there's a way to get fresh produce here and it's not as bad of quality as you might think. And I just sort of feel like for me, just being from the Midwest, as well as with the kind of reporting that I do, that's not actually that surprising. Right. Because it's like, well, yeah, like supermarkets and communities like tend to do okay with that.
Right. Well, like actually have produce.
Right. I'm like, I mean, it's the sort of stuff that I grew up with in like the rural Midwest, right? Like it's not beautiful farm fresh stuff, but it's also all right and you can get by on it.
Well, it's kind of, you bring up an interesting point about food writing is that in many ways it's very black and white. It's very much like there's a good and then there's a bad, there's a good and there's an evil, and Walmart can be cast as evil. And so, you know, and that it was never a good place to go I think it's probably one of the biggest buyers of organic produce at this point. Right?
I'm pretty sure it might very well be the biggest one. It's the largest grocery store in both the U.S. and the world at this point.
So. They're also really changing the fish buying market right now. They've laid down this internal edict that says we're only buying sustainably raised fish. Or not even just sustainably raised, but also caught from sustainable fisheries, which, you know, as Americans, and I think particularly as this type of American who lives in Brooklyn and are who we are, we walk around a lot thinking like, as Americans, we kind of suck. But it turns out, Americans are actually some of the most responsible fisheries in the world, which is, you know, kind of warms my heart a bit. But, you know, Walmart has a tremendous amount of purchasing power, and they're totally changing, I think, both the organic market for in ways that I think are, you know, more complicated than just, you know, good and bad. Like the whole purity police of walking into Whole Foods and thinking that everything is going to be good just because it's in Whole Foods. But I think, you know, the sustainable fisheries stuff is really impressive on Walmart's part.
Where did you learn about that?
I learned about it in a documentary that was screened at Union Docks a couple of weeks ago, and I'm totally forgetting the name of it. It's something like, has a pun, and there's ocean or sea in the title. I'm sure it's still on the Union Docks site. And, you know, they were covering this Walmart bit and also the fact that the United States is pretty responsible.
Well, while I've got you on the microphone, I want to ask you something that you read recently that you either thought was excellent or you were like, that's totally what I would like to be doing more of. Or even something that you've written yourself that you're like, yes, this is like when you're doing Brooklyn based or the local, something that was just like, yes, that's totally where I want us to be.
For me, there was a time when I was reading food writing and I always wanted to hear about that new ingredient or that thing or whatever, something that was like that I could eat. And now what I really want to read is stories about the intersection of food and agriculture, which as someone who tries to write those stories, it's really hard to find a place for them to live a lot of the time.
Right.
There's
no reader service. In many cases,
yeah,
which is what every publication,
except for ours. Like, I feel like food writing is so important. It's started to have this political power, but at the same time, it gets stuck in what I would think of as like a lifestyle ghetto.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's in the lifestyle section in the Times, which is in the same section as the style section, which is like, really?
Right.
But not that there's not good style articles. There are, but... I feel like food writing has the opportunity to be more powerful than that. And actually, one article that I read that, you know, made me think that I could write for the Times was what Indrani wrote about grain mills.
Yes.
In around the country. That's one that, like, I thought was this type of new journal or new food writing that's about agriculture as much as it is about an eating experience that I find really interesting.
How did that, Johnny? How did that? Was that something that you pitched to the Times, or did they come to you?
That was actually something that I pitched, but when I pitched it, the editors there said, "Oh yeah, we've been wanting to do something about this."
About local grains,
mm-hmm. And it actually came to me in the course of reporting another story, which was a little bit more of a kind of not politics story, but it was about green market and the sourcing of the producer only rules at green
right.
market. And in the course of that, someone who worked for green market said to me, you know, that you're really missing the real story. June Russell, one of the inspectors for green market at the time, she said, you're missing the real story. The real story is about grains. And I was like, well, you know, maybe that is the real story. So that it ended up opening up the doors to this really interesting world around local flours, which is what, you know, flour is one of those ingredients that we just kind of assume that we can't get locally because there haven't been flour mills, just as there haven't been slaughterhouses. There haven't been kind of local industries around these kinds of foods for so many years that we've kind of forgotten that there used to be all kinds of, you know, grain mills and slaughterhouses and all of that.
So, I mean, what I'm hearing is that it's what we're talking about is the things that we care to read about are not recipe driven or not are not about cooking, but the behind the scenes working of food industry and people who create food in many ways. But do any of you in this room actually geek out on regular food magazines and
Absolutely.
Recipes? Yeah. I actually find them more, yeah. the longer I've been a food writer, the longer it's been my career, the more I'm like, oh, now I really just want to like read epicurious.com.
Yeah.
Like, you know, oh, what about you? Okay. Ava.
Yes.
So when you open up your copy of Savour, do you get Savour? We can pretend. Sure. Yes.
You do? Yes. Okay, so
you put in a copy of Savour every month. Do you read the essay on the traditions and the history of masa making, or do you go straight to the tamale pie recipe? What do you go to for first?
Probably the former.
The really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I would say also that since we're gonna I wanna kinda join the I'm an Indrani Sen fan. and she just, speaking of Savour, she wrote like an amazing piece about her grandmother. When was that published, Indrani?
Years ago.
Okay, well, it's like as fresh and lively as.
Like, it's not like a decade.
Three or four.
It was a lovely story about, you know, a grandmother in India, class differences with servants, sort of like uncomfortable feelings, just amazing, you know, descriptions of food and interactions and people and family. It was really lovely and I think really inspiring. So I'm really glad that you sent it to me.
Well, so that story is less, you know, picking apart an issue or something contemporary, and that's basically a biographical piece. So what is it about that piece per se that really struck you as great food writing? I'm going to put you on the spot.
I think part of it is just you know, it's you want that kind of evocative writing, you know, to really speak to you, and you know, she really did it. I thought it was really amazing. And it doesn't have to be just about recipes. You did have a couple. Did you have recipes in there? I don't remember. Yeah. You know, it was about, you know, what food means to a family, connections between the people in a household, and who your family is. It's familial connections, it's relations, but it's also the relationships you have with the people who live in your home.
Right.
Right. So
adding complexity to things.
Yes.
I've always thought, but one of my favorite ways to do a straight recipe story is if it's something that you've made over and over and over again, or there's some personal connection, and I think, you know, who is it? It's like Melissa Clark does it in some ways because she writes about like her working on it every like over the course of a week to perfect her recipe. But where you read a story about someone whose grandmother made pimento cheese for their entire life, and then you get the recipe, and like that one little recipe is so much more meaningful than anything else. But it's like this backstory. And I actually, see, I knew that just telling who you guys were was going to use up so much of the first half of the show, so we're going to have to come back and talk more about blogging and Eater and Grub Street. That's what I want to talk about when we come back. All right, this is Brooklyn Eats, heritageradionetwork.com. That was Frank Schaap doing Sunny Side of the Street. You can catch him at Bar Bess here in Brooklyn, because at Edible Brooklyn, we like to keep our music local as well. This is Brooklyn Eats on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm Rachel Wharton, the deputy editor of Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan. And our sponsor today is Whole Foods. We are here talking about food writing, what we like and what we don't like. And in part two of this show, I want to talk about blogs. Actually, most of us in this room actually blog in various shapes, sizes, and forms in many ways. But one thing I really want to talk about is particular type of blog here in New York City, like the hyperspace following gossip and trends and new openings and sordid details of, you know, of chefs and hangers-on, like, I won't even say any names, but what do you guys think? Are average readers or average people who are interested in food and recipes and cooking or even going out to restaurants, is this something that's good for them? Are they reading them? What do you think? All right, so I'm going to pick one of you looking. Andrani.
Well, I'll definitely say that at the local, we get more interest in our food-related blogs, like Ava's excellent column, The Urban Forager, than we do in pretty much anything else, I would say. I mean, sometimes a really controversial issue will get more comments, but...
Right. Like crime too. Food and crime. Food and crime.
Yeah. Food crimes, that guy who got hit by the subway train, wasn't that was like a huge one. Sorry, this is totally a digression. Right. But do you remember that one?
That was pretty big.
Yes.
Yeah. There's actually a Twitter feed that's all meat crimes. I mean, now we're going like really far afield, but yeah.
That's great. Really?
It's I think they might even be like at meat crimes. That might not be exactly right, but it's pretty easily searchable.
What kind of crimes happen with meat?
A lot of shoplifting. Mm. I've sort of fallen off my Twitter obsession in the past couple of weeks, but so I don't have any recent ones loaded into my brain right now. But yeah, meat crimes.
Well, in terms of the local, isn't oral fixation very popular?
What is oral fixation?
Oral fixation is, well, do you want to describe it since?
It's more restaurant oriented, whereas Ava's at Calm is, you know, a urban forager. It's fairly self-explanatory. So this fantastic writer, Kate Bloom, goes to a different restaurant every week. We're doing a new structure where she's doing breakfast, lunch, and then dinner. So over the course of, about 6 weeks, you get a full meal in Fort Greene or Clinton Hill or a combination. And people love to have an opinion about especially a local place. People are very into that.
It's like a restaurant review.
Right now, the last thing that she did was the Bagel Olympics, where she compared bagels, which is a little bit different than your traditional restaurant review, but it does capture that same sort of like blog reader interest, strong opinion. I mean, I can't think of anything, you know, really stronger than New Yorkers' opinions about bagels. So
yes, this is just in Fort Greene and Clinton Hill,
correct?
Yeah. I mean, so that is one major difference about. I mean, just online is that now. I mean, now there's an interaction with the reader gets to say what they think about what you said about a bagel. Right. They never did before, absolutely. Except by letters, and then you could decide not to print them.
I kind of at this point, I kind of want to allow me to wave the banner for rah-rah, all of this. Social media and digital journalism is really good for food writing, just for a moment. I think there are probably things that are positive and things that are negative, but if I can wave the banner for a second, I think that one of the things that I noticed, just even in terms of the maple syrup story, I posted a story about tapping a maple tree, right, in Fort Greene. And which you know about.
Yes.
And
I think it's awesome that people are doing that here.
And of course, people posted and made comments that were generally pretty positive. And somebody all the way from Canada actually posted a comment about the various uses, that culinary uses of sap. Now, I'm a Chinese girl from Queens. I don't know anything really about cooking with sap, right? Mm-hmm. But he mentioned poaching eggs in sap. And eventually, I had kind of forgotten about this, but one of my readers on Twitter mentioned the fact that, she'd been dreaming about eggs poached in sap.
In actual sap or maple syrup?
In actual sap.
Oh, because it's just very, like, just it's barely super sweet water.
It's totally very, very watery and that really delicious. That is insane. And from that, you know, from these comments, the next post is about poaching eggs in sap, which you can find posted tomorrow. Right. So, you know, so there is a kind of like interesting.
Wait, you have to give the web address. Self-promotion.
Oh, dear. It's housed on the New York Times site. So if you go to the blogs, it's the local. Honestly, I can't believe that I don't know this. I feel like.
If
just Google Urban Forager.
If you Google the local and Fort Greene, you'll find it.
Yes, exactly. So there's an instance where, the reaction was fairly immediate. Someone made suggestions about, you know, recipes that I would never have known about, right?
Right.
And we tend to think of ourselves as, like, being very hyper-local.
Who was the first person that poached an egg in sap? And why?
I do not know.
Likely a Canadian.
Probably a Canadian. They do it in Vermont, too, so.
That is insane. You've done it already?
Yeah.
You can't reveal whether it was amazing or... Because we have to wait to read it tomorrow, I suppose.
Yes, you'll just have to wait and see.
Well, that's okay. So this goes back to everything we were saying before. It's the complexity in the backstory. It's like people who are allowed. You never would have gotten that deep of information if this story hadn't been online, right. Or it would have taken weeks and weeks of letters, and you know, eventually someone would have read it. And you know, I'm glad that you brought up this point, because I really loved your sap, your maple syruping, your sugaring post, particularly because what was it, like 3,000 words? It was really long.
It was a fairly long.
And there's no way in hell that would have run in any paper. I mean, you never would have been able to go that long about just trying to find a maple tree in Brooklyn and going to the plumbing hardware store to find. I mean, that's one thing that's great about online, is that it's supposed to be 250 word posts, but in a lot of ways you can get away with writing what you want to write at the length that should be written, which is nice.
Right. That's right.
Well, and if I can just interject as someone who does a lot of freelance stuff but hasn't been publishing a lot because of the book work, right? Like, one of the things I found really cool about doing blog stuff, because I have this, like, $5 dinner blog where I sort of sometimes write some stuff, right? Is that, like...
That basically describes every blog ever.
I'm not very disciplined. Stuff. But, like, editors will find it and, like, find you. So, like, the other... You know, I have a little Google alert that tells me when my name is published somewhere, right? And, like... All of a sudden, I'm like, I'm in the first few graphs of some column at the American Prospect. I had no idea. I never talked to them, right? And because I had written something about, like, food in class. I don't even remember exactly. But, like, it kind of creates, like, such a cool conversation where I think this is a really big part of how food is becoming a bigger and broader issue, because it's so much easier to find people that are saying interesting things about and able to make those connections in ways that before, because you had these gatekeepers at elite publications, it was a lot harder, right? You'd have to find an editor who was like, yes, I totally want to start talking about food and poverty. Like, who the hell would give me like that assignment? Like, nobody, right? But like, I sit there in my little blog and somebody Googles and they Tumblr and what, I don't know what they do.
Unless a celebrity hosts the fundraising auction.
Yeah, not at my...
I spent 5 years at the Daily News. I was like, never something would come across my desk where I'd be like, oh, fuck yeah. Sorry, like, you know, whoever celebrity was hosting some fundraiser about sustainability, I'm like, score! I can finally get this in the paper. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead. But then I actually, you were talking about gatekeeping. And that's one thing I think is really interesting, is I remember when I first started the Daily News, which is 2003, we still did a new openings column where we would decide what we thought was interesting, what we would write 2 to 3 sentences about, you know, of the bajillion restaurants that open, the bazillion, you know, specialty food stores that open, et cetera, the beers, you know, the new, and I mean, that is pretty much gone out the window. Now every press release, everything is, because there are people just need content for websites. There's very little filtering of food news and things right now, which I think is interesting. And I think, just from talking to my friends who are not in the food world, that they don't realize that it's not being filtered anymore. I mean, they do think that anything they read, even if it's online or in print, is some... I'm not talking directly to Mike, I'm sorry. It's something that's been decided that is worth reading about, and that's not necessarily the case. Anybody care to comment? No. Come on.
I like filters. I just don't like them when they exclude me.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's sort of, as a freelancer, that's sort of what the deal is, right? Like, I don't have the same, like, I don't work at a specific publication. So, like, the sort of threshold you have to cross as a writer to get an assignment is a lot higher than if you're somebody on staff who can be like, I'm thinking about this idea. And the editor's like, well, maybe I'll think about this. And
You had to work late 3 days a week. I'll let you write about that.
So, like, now that I'm a freelancer and an author, I kind of like that it's more open. At the same time, you get a lot more crap when people aren't filtering and actually sort of bringing a critical thought process to what gets published and what's get out there.
And is this a good thing or a bad thing, or both?
I think it's both. I mean, on the one hand, for, you know, we teach, right? And we have these, you know, young aspiring journalists, like, just, you know, like, yapping at the bit, like, all, like, excited about, you know, getting published. And I think they're feeling actually a little demoralized about what's happening in the industry, because, of course, what's happening is that while there's actually greater opportunity to publish your work online, right? But there's also less opportunity to actually get paid for it.
Right.
And that's the kind of thing that I think all writers, whether you're a food writer or not, we're all feeling it, right? But of course, the positive thing for a young writer is that there is greater opportunity to get your voice heard. But or rather your voice out there. The problem, of course, is that, I mean, I happen to like filters. I like editors. Editors help us. They make our work totally. Better. And the problem with, you know, so many websites and blogs that are unedited, you know, on the one hand, I mean, you could get somebody really great. On the other, it's just there's a lot of noise out there. And how do you sift through it?
I don't know. I think I feel like my head is going to explode on a daily basis because there's like 800 things that I should have read but hadn't.
I think also, I mean, yeah, I so agree with you on the not getting paid thing. I mean, there's so much good content out there that people must think, this is a great article. Someone must have gotten paid to write this. That isn't. Like the Atlantic Food Channel, right. No one's getting paid to write anything on that. Right. They have some great contributors, but no one is getting paid anything.
I don't think they're getting paid for Savour either.
No, I know that the online of Savour is not paid either for the most part. I think that that's somewhat negotiable. And then a lot of the online gourmet was not paid either.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. And just as somebody who covers sort of like the social implications and social policy stuff around food, I feel like that really skews things a lot, right? Because then you're only really able to publish writers who have enough income from some other source that they don't really need to engage with like questions of sustain, like their own personal financial sustainability or anything. Like you can, it's sort of like pre-selecting for people who have some other really cushy job that's like flexible enough that they can write, or someone who has a trust fund, like
right, or someone who's so young it's their, you know, they're, it's like you have the top and the bottom, right. And no middle in a way, because it's, you know, it's the
right. And so I think part of that, right, is how food gets to be considered a luxury lifestyle product. Mm-hmm. Right, is that you have people who can sort of treat it that way because they have other options, as opposed to dealing with the sort of more collective and, like, for me, like, what's sort of really inspiring about food, which is that everybody experiences hunger and everyone understands food in ways that we don't understand, like, class and, like, economics and all those other things that are much harder to sort of get people to start talking about. Like, food's this amazing universalizing experience.
I mean, I guess maybe just playing devil's advocate a little bit, I think that there's an opportunity for a lot of people to write about food with the internet that was not available when the only people that were writing about food were writing for the magazines or the New York Times or the newspapers or whatever.
I'm talking here about people who are trying to make a living at it type of thing and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, I do think we're hearing more voices and hearing voices from a wider range of class backgrounds on the internet than we were hearing in the print media.
That's definitely true. I mean, and it's I don't know, it's like, but how does that change this? Is that why all of a sudden there's more layers to food writing? Because for such a long time, gatekeepers were only the wealthy and the moneyed and the big city people. So it was all about restaurants and expensive goods, and now it's breaking down into so many different factors. Does that play a role in it? Is that it's opened up?
You mean that about the subject matter that people are writing about?
Right. I mean, is that related? I mean, why all of a sudden can we write about food? But like what Tracy's doing, or you know, the historical background to your recipe. Why is that all of a sudden of interest to more people?
That's a pretty big question.
Yeah. Is it actually of interest to more people? Are we just hoping that it is?
Well, I think Andrani is making a really good point, right? Which is that because you can actually get stuff out there, even if it's not paid, mm-hmm. there's a way in which it does open up dialogue and discussion, right? Because you can sort of be like, well, I'm just really passionate about this. I'm like, screw it. I'm just going to write
right.
and figure it out. And
we
you
don't have
open...
to worry about whether our big liquor sponsor likes
right.
this article.
Because before
or not.
It was like, you had to be somebody who was on staff at the Times and earning a salary and could have like this very comfortable middle class lifestyle to write about food. And now you can have people who are totally like, I make $1,200 a month and I pay rent in New York and I'm still obsessed with food. And
so I guess the question is, are those people writing? And if so, where for? I mean, we're definitely looking for those people at the local. So, I mean,
anybody care if it's community journalism.
So if anyone out there is interested in lives in Fort Greene or Clinton Hill and wants to write for the local, about what it's like eating on $12,000 a year, we're really eager to hear that. And the outlets exist. I think part of the issue is how do the people who we hope will be writing about that kind of thing maybe don't necessarily have the time to, maybe aren't hearing the call, aren't listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Wait, so what are you specifically looking for? People, it's the practical day by day of what it's like to live on a fixed income in that neighborhood.
Well, like for instance, one of the big stories on the local recently has been about the Fort Greene Food Co-op, and there's been this really interesting debate happening, partly in the Post, but also in the comments, about whether co-ops are something just for the rich, or whether they're whether they're something that can help a single mother on welfare make ends meet, and part of that is around the work requirement, and it's an interesting question that we don't really know the answer to, and we're very eager to hear from not just there's been a lot of kind of the hypothetical welfare mother with two kids who makes X amount per year, but we haven't really heard from her on our blog, and we would love to hear from her.
And why do you think you haven't? Because they no access to actually even reading it.
I think that this is a question that we're asking ourselves right now. I mean, how do we extend our reach? How do we get people interested in being a part of what we're doing? I don't have a good answer for it, but it's something that we're challenging ourselves on right now. I don't know if you want to add to that, Annalise.
I think it goes back to what we were saying before about the internet sort of broadening the horizon. Like, the gatekeepers for media have traditionally been middle class and white. And I think that in addition to adding access, we have to cultivate the idea that, anyone and everyone is in some way, entitled is a strong word, but is, in the situation of the local, if you're living in Fort Greene, you're entitled to have your voice heard by the local and for us to be a platform for you.
I think that the co-op thing is, that takes it back to the, at the very beginning of this show, we were talking about Walmart and how it's so easy, and when you're writing about these issues, to just be very black and white. And it was the complexity of Indrani's local grains article. The complexity of the co-op article. It's like a co-op sounds like a fabulous idea, but then there's all these different layers and whether there's access to everyone. And it's these types of things. It's like looking at food writing from a 360 degree view that I think the articles that we all want to see more of in the future. What do you guys think?
Mm-hmm. I'm down.
All right. This has been an incredibly wonderful edition of Brooklyn Eats on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. There you go.